You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Pierre Dorenza. It's easy to forget that the cultural archetypes that pass for queerness today have historical roots. Some of these roots are merely years away from today's reality, but they are nonetheless distinct and come with their own artifacts and subcultures. Peter Rehberg's book Hipster Porn looks at one such source artifact and its fandom, using as its matter the pink-papered magazine Butt that gained a cult following among European gay men in the first decade of the 2000s. Hipster Porn takes the aesthetics of Butt to critique and re-articulate key concepts from gender, queer and affect theories, and delivers new accounts of subjectivity and sociality as they apply to queer media culture. Peter Rehberg is a writer, critic and curator, and I'm very happy that he joins me now. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I've realized as I was reading through the book that I've set myself up for an exquisite failure here, Peter. I am by no means an expert. Well, I'm frankly only vaguely literate with the ins and outs of queer theory. So if I come across as remotely knowledgeable in a conversation, it will probably be because I have been exposed to gay pornography more than it is advisable to admit to at the beginning of a conversation. So before we get into why any of that is, I might ask you to expose yourself a little bit in whichever form you particularly want to. I'm interested particularly in your professional formation, how it is that you came to be interested in Butt magazine, but also I'm interested in your work with Berlin Schwulles Museum.
Thank you. And thanks again for inviting me to this podcast. So Peter Rehberg is my name. I come from Germany, born in Hamburg, but I've spent my adult life pretty much half in the United States, half in Germany. My academic training has mostly been in the United States. So I have a PhD in literature, researched and taught at several universities in the United States. My academic profile is mostly, you know, although I'm coming from a German studies background, with a very strong interest in, you know, what we used to call French theory. So I'm trained in the late 1990s, early 2000s by scholars like Avital Ronell, for example. So basically, I wrote a very theory-heavy dissertation on Kafka, Freud, and Derrida. And although that training and thinking critically and also a certain canon or archive of deconstruction is still part of my work in terms of the material. Let's just say this, after the dissertation, I've never touched literature again from an academic position, but just for creative purposes. I'm also writing literature, but that's a different story. So anyways, like academically, after my dissertation, I really became a queer studies scholar with a strong interest in theory and queer theory and, you know, further developing, criticizing queer theory. And mostly talking about popular culture and visual culture, including pornography, including gay pornography, online pornography, popular culture, including the Eurovision Song Contest. So these are my research areas.
I do remember we met not so long ago in person, and you were an endless treasure of Eurovision trivia. So maybe we can do a little quick fire round at the end.
Totally. So the Eurovision book is not BIN, which is, of course, you know, a huge topic also because it's going to be hosted in either Liverpool or Glasgow next year. So the Eurovision book has not been published yet. Oh, it's not ready yet, but, you know, there's a research project also in the line on queer subjectivity, European identity, and Eurovision. So the project I've been working on, so let's just say in the past 10 years, I'm really mostly working on queer visual culture, contemporary art, gay pornography. And the project that we're going to talk about today, hipster porn, queer masculinities, and affective sexualities in the fanzine, but is where those interests came together. At the beginning of the 2010s, I had a 5-year position in Austin, Texas. And it was mostly during that time that I worked on this project, hipster porn, gave tons of talks on Butt Magazine, which I'm still doing, actually, just last week in Bochum at a art history conference, talking about the relaunched. But also, since you've already mentioned that, I don't only have just some academic career, but also career outside of academia and journalism, but also in museum work, archiving and curating. So for the past 4 years, I've been appointed as head of collections and archives at Schulz Museum in Berlin, which in the German-speaking world is the largest of its kind, and also one of the larger queer museum and archival institutions globally. And at Schulz Museum, I also curated shows on contemporary art and photography. But now I'm actually back in academia for a while, and I hold the position of visiting professor at the University of Cincinnati. It's a confusing biography. I'm really...
We're following, and I'm sort of envious of your retreat to Cincinnati, which you just assumed a few weeks ago. Right, let's try to figure out what we're looking at. Butt Magazine. I have a very hazy memory of it, and I've realized that most of the memories of it that I have come from a 2014 edition from Taschenbuchs, which reprinted a whole bunch of it. Any magazine that gets reproduced with this kind of type of popular publisher must have done something. Butt Magazine was published between 2001 and 2011, if I'm right. And it's very difficult to really pin down. So why don't you have a stab?
Yeah, I mean, let's maybe start by saying fanzines have been part of subcultures and also including queer subcultures for quite some time. So especially, for example, in the 1970s, from Toronto, Bruce LaBruce, but also Suck from Amsterdam, from the Netherlands. So we had always, you know, local cultural contexts that produced fanzines back then in the 70s in a very different media environment. And those zines back then were mostly produced as, you know, Xeroxes. Handmade Xeroxes, and then distributed and sent by mail. If one looks at it from a, say, media history perspective, one could say there's a certain promise to the fanzine, attached to the fanzine, a promise of something true or honest will be shown or told in this medium, because it has a direct access to the subculture. It is exempt from certain norms of publishing or normative forms of representation, right? So that's kind of the aura of the fanzine that we know from, for example, the 1970s. Around 2000, we had a renaissance of fanzines, particularly of queer fanzines. Butt is coming from Amsterdam. We had also, for example, They Don't Shoot Homos, Don't They, from Melbourne. We had Basso from Berlin. So there's a huge, I mean, at least 10 or so, you know, that started to emerge around 2000. There have been exhibitions. A.A. Bronson has also curated exhibitions on this new wave of fanzines. Yeah. There have been catalogs that document that. And Butt is part of that new wave of fanzines that emerged around 2000s. It lived for 10 years, as you said. I mean, maybe an initial quick answer of why that happened. In terms of media history, I would say it has a lot to do with the internet. because the internet allowed for a circulation of amateur photography, including amateur pornography, on a scale that was just not imaginable in the first half of the 1990s, right? So suddenly we were surrounded by completely different visual politics that were kind of fueled through this possibility and then desire of self-documentation. But, and other fanzines in my mind are a response to that. You know, they kind of take up, they channel this new visual landscape. And this is the interesting thing, of course, they don't create a website. I mean, they have that too, but that's not the initial move, but they bring it back to print. It's a sort of like remediation, you know, which a backward remediation, which has a lot to do with, and that's also, you know, the title of my book, with the hipster culture, although hipster might also be a bit of an ungenerous title, because I have to say, I dearly love Butt, and the makers of Butt didn't like the title of my book. They still gave me permission to print the images. I don't mean hipster. Hipster for me is a very ambiguous category. We probably get to speak about it later.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just mentioning it here because the remediation to print is also along the lines of a certain hipster fetishization of the analog and the self-made. Mm-hmm. Brewing coffee, you know, like roasting coffee, brewing beer, making your own fanzine, right? So a certain kind of...
That's you're describing my weekends, essentially. I feel seen.
Yes. So, you know, like this is this fetishization of as a response. So the analog as a response of being surrounded by digital imagery. I think this explains in one way the emergence of a variety of zines around that time. Hmm. If we're talking about Butt in particular, Butt is not just a zine, but also a zine that offers a very specific body politics. I think one a first explanation to the new visual style of Butt, you know, which I'm naming hipster, and but maybe to give it a little bit more of an idea, what kind of style are we talking about? It's a less conform style of masculinity if we compare it, for example, to gay pornography of the 1980s and 1990s. You know, we do have muscular bodies, but we also have fat bodies, we also have thin bodies. So there is not just one dominant norm that allows you access to the pages of Butt. It is probably age in a certain way. You know, we find very little old people, very few old people. It is also in a certain way race, but is a very white project. I think out of 29 covers before 2011, we have maybe three covers with non-white people. However, in terms of, if we're thinking about it generally in terms of masculinity, fit masculinity, gay masculinity, it's definitely an alternative form of masculinity in terms of body politics. And in my mind, that is a reaction to the AIDS crisis. So maybe to explain that just briefly, if we say that AIDS was not just a human and a health crisis and a medical crisis and a social and cultural crisis, it was also a crisis of representation. And one of the points of discussion of the AIDS crisis in the 1980s was, of course, how to present gay male body with HIV. You know, and we have different responses to that from popular media, the scandalization of Rock Hudson's body or Freddie Mercury's body. We also have a certain exploitative view on the suffering gay body in general. And one of the responses here was, for example, by the gay porn industry to assert the strength and the health and the fitness of gay men, you know, and to give us these very buff gym bodies that populated gay pornography in the 1980s and 1990s. Since 1996, we have the combination therapy that turned HIV from a mostly deadly disease into a chronic illness that is very manageable. Mm-hmm. So you could say by the time of 2001, when Butt emerged, those, you know, as in gay slang, sometimes called fascist body politics of just asserting your health, were not necessary in the same way anymore. Normal bodies could be shown again.
So this is super interesting. It might be a good idea to give our listeners some of a kind of visual set of cues, if we can do that descriptively, because the aesthetic that you describe is kind of recognizable to, I think it's recognizable to your generation and my generation, but definitely won't be that recognizable to younger listeners for whom the zine no longer has the idea of print, and the zine kind of coincides with the TikTok age a little bit too much. I'm afraid I've taken down a couple of citations from the BUT website of titles and headlines to kind of give us a taste. So I maybe ask you to fill in. I'm going to read out a couple of that that are just amusing. Artist is compelled to sack jaw-breaking dick during random grinder hookup with cocktease. That is in a section called Sex Reviews. Another one, New York tourist meets West Hollywood bubble butt for sex. I think that that gives us an idea of the kind of written content that we might be finding in this magazine, of course, because it's a porn publication. It does talk about sex explicitly, it does talk about the porn industry, it does talk about porn films. But actually, the magazine is also filled with a lot of kind of political lifestyle pieces. It almost passes this kind of Playboy defense of, you know, we're here for the articles. So maybe I could ask you to give us a little bit of a taste of the kind of how, where it pitches itself, this publication, in all the possible senses of high and lowbrow, sexual and cultural, and how these things coincide.
All right. So let's maybe start by taking up the word you mentioned, porn publication. I mean, is BUT really a porn publication? I think that's not entirely sure. I'm calling my book Hipster Porn, yes. And, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, queer, especially gay sexuality and pleasure do have a very emphasized standing in the context of BUT. It's also true that porn stars, François Sagar, Akos Mipat, you know, like established porn stars from major labels, continuously appear in BUT. Mm-hmm. That's true. But they do appear, you know, next to John Waters or Bruce LaBruce or A.A. Bronson, right? So it's a very, I mean, a quick label would also be to call it art porn in several ways. I mean, just not just in the combination of art and porn, but also in its take on representing the nude male body. And maybe we start a little bit by talking about the photographs, because yes, they are, let's just say this. I think the formula of BUT, visually the formula of BUT is, and we should say that maybe also, it consists of usually six, maybe eight stories. These are our interviews, nothing but interviews, plus photographs taken quite often by very famous photographers like Wolfgang Tillmans,
He comes up.
Yes.
Time and again.
Yes, he's part of the editorial team. Bruce LaBruce calls him the signature photographer for BUT. And one could also obviously say that the whole BUT style owes a lot to Tillmans's early 1990s club pictures, et cetera, et cetera. Or also fashion photography, is Terry Richardson plays a huge role. Anyway, so we have, you know, male nudity is the focus. That's true. I've never been a BUT shooting, but my sense is that the BUT editors try to persuade the interviewee to undress, and mostly they manage, but sometimes they don't. I mean, Michael Stipe from REM keeps his boxers on, for example, right?
Unforgivable.
Exactly. So nudity is there. If we're like just checking the question of pornography here, we hardly ever see hard dicks, except when hard dicks is turned into a special interest of the story. Then hard cocks do appear in that one story. We never see sexual action, maybe jerking off, or maybe mutual jerking off, or kind of. But we never see butt fucking. There's no sexual action in BUT. So it's the like usually the models are isolated in the picture. That mostly at home or at their workplace, so a place that somehow individually relates to them. So what's interesting here to me is that yes, it is about sexuality, but it's not about sexuality as a pornographic value necessarily. It's not necessarily jerk off material, but it's more about gay masculinity, maleness, sexuality placed in an everyday context. you know? And I think this could be a bridge to the headlines you were talking about that both appear on the websites and also within the magazine. I mean, the headlines are usually funny, you know, or oftentimes funny, as the examples that you gave us. They're making a joke. Yeah, they're sexual. They're kind of jokes. But the question
is kind of clickbaity, very knowingly.
Yes,
they really contrast with the otherwise kind of semi-intellectual approach of the magazine.
I agree, and they, you know, if we speak about that conceptually or theoretically, I think what it does, it brings different spheres together, right? Like a hobby like gardening and the fact that someone is an escort, or the fact that someone has a big dig but has an interest in old books, right? So it kind of combines these apparently unmatchable things. And I think the question is, why is that funny, right? And it kind of is funny, but I mean, one... And of course, every theoretical explanation of a joke destroys the joke. That's the sad thing.
Unfortunately, I'm so sorry to pin you on this. You do try to explain the joke in your own book. So, so leave Freud alone, I would say, at this moment.
There's something interesting is going on when you contextualize sexuality and you don't give it the extraordinary place that it also kind of claims in porn. You know, porn is a dream, or porn is a holiday from life where different rules apply, right? It's porn has almost this validated utopian position. But sexuality is brought back to to eating, to working, to farting, to boredom. So it's placed in a very different, in an everyday, like where it is, one might say. You know, you could also say that's the documentary value of butt in a sense. So yes, it is. In that sense, I would say it's more documenting sexuality in the context of gay and queer lifestyles and not so much pornographic.
All right. So we're not looking at porn. And I think that's a good moment to try to consider a little bit the place of Butt Magazine in relationship to what is in the 2000s, the emergent gay mainstream, so that we can try to begin to theorize a little bit what it is that I was trying to do. So what is happening in the mainstream? I would hazard that in the kind of European Western milieu, the early 2000s are a place of the metrosexual. You mentioned already that the post-AIDS crisis, or at least post the acute moment of the AIDS crisis, gay pornography has this kind of body ideal, which is funny enough now has become the realm of the right wing, particularly in the US. You know, like going to the gym is supposedly the thing that the straight social conservative is supposed to do. But we're in this kind of strange moment where gay culture starts getting really widespread commercial and is in a very, very strange moment when it doesn't know whether it wants to follow this kind of finally free neoliberal consumerism, commercialism that I think heterosexuality is definitely subject to. So how does Butt Magazine relate to those forms?
You're absolutely right. And these social, political, economic, cultural tendencies have also been reflected by queer theory, just to give maybe a couple of keywords here. You know, since the 2000s, we are discussing homonormativity, for example, right? So that under certain conditions, race and ethnicity and class are obviously crucial here. Gay people gain access to neoliberal privilege in a new form that in a way, let's just say in quotation marks, accepts homosexuality, but I mean in my mind under two conditions. It's the form of the couple, you know, which is not socially threatening for a mainstream society, and also I would say and that's a bit of a paradoxical, complicated situation, but still I would say in a desexualized way. I mean, we do see gay people in the public on television. We have Queer as Folk and other productions. We have gay comedies, but you know, in mainstream production, gay people, men and women, usually don't have sex. So which is paradoxical in the sense that it is sexuality that defines gay people as a social minority. So we have homonormativity both on the level of representation. We have it on the level of lawmaking and legislation with access to marriage and adoption rights. And maybe to go one step further, we have it also on the level of national politics. You know, there's not just the discussion about homonormativity, but also the discussion about homonationalism. Mm-hmm. So the question in which ways gay people in the army, in which ways the access to privilege is not just, say, an individual economic benefit, but also in the context of a national narration in which gay people are now included and also offer them, you know, openly a quite conservative place in national mm-hmm. politics, which is, and I mean, not that gay people were not conservative before, but they could not necessarily be it as gay people, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that is an important difference here, this offer, this open offer made to conservative gay positions in national politics. So that is, you know, just in a theoretical language, I think maybe to take up some of the ideas and assessments that you gave about the 2000s. If this is what the 2000s are, yes, how does Butt is part of that, and how does it offer a different world, right? Let's just say this. I'm a fan of Butt, you know, I'm a fanboy.
I think that's clear. That's already come through. Don't worry.
So I don't want to say like bad things about Butt, but I'm of course also an academic, you know, or I'm trying to think about this critically. So I cannot just sell. Part of me is nothing but celebrating Butt, and part of me, you know, since I wrote this book is not just a fan mail, you know, it's also a critical engagement with the project. And I would say that Butt is a bit ambiguous here, but maybe let's just start with what is really worth celebrating about Butt. You know, I mentioned already this response to body politics of the 1980s mm-hmm. and 1990s. So one could say Butt's body politics, they become, you know, readable in the context of AIDS, but they are also, of course, initially form of, they show uncommodified bodies. You know, if we compare it to the metrosexual, if we compare it to the gym body, if we compare it to the porn body, the emergence of Butt marked a moment of non-commodified bodies. Mm-hmm. In 2022, this might look a little bit different, but I think if we look at it historically, at the moment of its emergence, this is what it achieved. So, you know, you didn't have to go to the gym, you didn't have to be marked by fashion labels, although at the very same time, fashion and fashion advertisement played a huge role in, but it's a paradoxical situation, right? So you're like showing non-commodified bodies and placing them then again in a highly commodified context of high-end fashion advertisement in the zine itself, Marc Jacobs, Adidas, etc., mm-hmm. right? Anyways, so in terms of queer culture and gay culture and historiography, I think Butt did achieve that, to offer a different, an alternative model of masculinity through its body politics that was not from the very start part of the neoliberal paradigm. Also, a second point, you know, as I said, I think the successful neoliberal gay subject was both masculinized but also desexualized subject, but certainly has an investment in bringing sex. I mean, there's no conversation about in Butt without sex, you know, and there's no, but completely refuses to partake in this economy of desexualizing gay culture. And I think this might be even the strongest, the most important achievement of Butt. So in that sense, it is a counter project to the normalizing tendencies of the 2000s, I would say. Mm-hmm. At the very same time, you know, Butt was not just available in gay bookstores, but it had a certain deal with, you know, a brand that is now out of business, American Apparel, you know, which American Apparel, this no label from California of the 2000s that brought us these plain t-shirts in funny colors, especially celebrated for their colorful underwear. You know, everybody had like American Apparel, turquoise or mauve underwear in the 2000s at one point, right? And this shows, of course, a process that certain subcultural values within in capitalism are in a heartbeat transformed into a market value, you know, and very quickly, but was could be accessed in this way and turned into a value, not just within a gay subculture, but also within a certain fashion market, you know. And I think that's also a strategy that the makers of Bud, Joop and Gerhard, from the very start pursued. I mean, they are like magazine makers, and they come from advertisement, you know. So they had an interest in bringing these fears together, maybe in a form that was not as destructive or exploitative as we know it from mainstream media.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Yeah, so I think we're at an interesting historical moment where the internet really kicks off in popular culture. You know, the 2000s are when everything is really finally open to, at least in Europe. But you point to the idea that queer theory stops being able to catch up with what is happening. And I want to ask you to give you some space to talk about the theoretical aspects of the book. I'm not going to say that it reads like your Kafka thesis, but there is a lot of quite hardcore theory in the book. So to anyone who would like to pick this up, hoping for a nice history, a nice kind of praise of the magazine, I direct you maybe to the Taschen volume instead. But I think it's really interesting what you do, particularly with how you try to rewrite the relationship between sexuality and gender as it plays out at that particular moment. I think that a lot of the things that you theorize and describe happening in the very early 2000s really have set the scene to how cultural sexual politics or gender politics really has played itself out to this very day. So theorize, please. How do we try to understand that moment
from
the perspective of earlier queer theories?
Okay, I'll try my best. So maybe for a start, we can just briefly, which I'm doing also in the organization of the chapters, distinguish gender from sexuality. Of course, they're always linked in many ways. So if we talk about gender, the theoretical paradigm to discuss gender since the early 1990s has been, of course, Judith Butler's Gender Trouble and Bodies That Matter from, I think, 91, 93, you know, around that time, English version, German version shortly afterwards. And the critical tool that Butler applied here is, as we know, performativity. And thinking about gender not in essential terms as something that is inherently given, biologically authorized, and this brings us obviously already to the debates that we're in right now, But as performative in the sense that gender only becomes an intelligible category for psychic and social life by being repeatedly performed. You have to again and again and again confirm, you know, that you're male or female, that you're a man or a woman. Mm-hmm. And if you fail to perform your gender, you will be sanctioned. You know, there will be repercussions against you. The ideas of Butler had a career that, you know, very few ideas in academia managed to get, you know, like it's been become so much part of our popular understanding of gender these days. Of the Pope talks about Butler, you know, like it's entered all kinds of discourses. Politicians talk about Butler. Anyways, the heroine or the hero or heroine for Butler's paradigm of gender performativity was the drag queen. Drag queen as an example also of how queer subcultures perform gender, experiment with performing gender, performing with the failure of performing gender, and how these investments in drag and camp and whatnot are essential to queer subcultures. So a lot of the focus on gender was a lot on the question of theatricality, artificiality, and so forth, you know. And if we think of the archive that queer has to offer, of course, a lot of examples come to mind from, you know, early cross-dressing cultures in Berlin of the 1920s, for example, to the present. So there is, you know, a validity and a huge value in Butler's work, which I'm, you know, summarizing here very, very crassly, generally, of course. Anyways, I'm making this point because, in my mind, but does not fit into the paradigm of performativity. And we could, you know, on a first level, we could say, for example, that but has not an interest in drag, but has not an interest in artificiality, but has not an interest in semiotic excess, you know. But Butt's project is to document the male body, the materiality of the male body, the forms of the male body. Yeah. So this is very far removed from a queer project that is invested in materiality. The question then is, if that's the case, is Butt even queer, or does Butt not bring us a kind of naturalized idea of masculinity back? I mean, one could also say that's the ideology of porn. Now I'm going back to but being, but the ideology of porn is, of course, also to show cis male bodies in a non-performative way, although porn is so much about performativity. Going back to Butt, so we have a documentation of the male body, of its forms, of its different shapes, and its interest in variation. I would say this is not performative, but it's doing something else. It's documenting the male body, but let's just say it documents it in a way, and this is a bit of a paradoxical thought, but I think it's really true for the project of Butt. It documents it in a way that is not necessarily reaffirming the ideology of masculinity. So we have forms, we have bodies that are completely recognizable as male, whose value it is to be male, but it's a form of maleness, and that's, you know, a strange thought maybe, it's a form of maleness that is not necessarily masculine. It's a form of maleness that is not asserting its masculine power. It's not, we could also simply say it's a form of maleness that is not phallic, yeah? But it shows like male vulnerability. So it kind of believes in the body as it is, but it doesn't believe in it as an example of male of masculine ideology, but it believes in it more as an arena of a variation of forms of male diversity and male vulnerability. All right, so that would be my statement about Butt's contribution to gender. But you also maybe you can bring me back to that by repeating it.
But the thing that comes up, and you've already alluded to it, that in this kind of dialectic between gender and sexuality, Butt maybe is a precursor of what it is that we're seeing now in popular culture, but has to give up a little bit on sexuality because it's not a porn magazine. It's not, you know, it's at best erotica. The men, even though the men in the magazine, even though they admit to having sex, they admit to being fully on board with asexuality, somehow don't express it in the way that we find in, say, the bareback porn movement that Lee Edelman talks about. And just to kind of give it a tiny bit of a flavor from my kind of cultural observations of now, one of the things that we culture commentators bemoan quite a lot is that while the youth of today, in inverted quotes, are very happy to talk about gender and talk about sexuality, somehow the younger generations of today are not having sex. So in a sense, I'm kind of interested in the conflict between trying to own gender again, having bypassed, as you propose in your theoretical framework, trying to bypass this kind of problematic need to perform gender, this really queer, it is what it is, laissez-faire, we're not performing to your, I mean, that would be the manifesto of But I Imagine. Yeah, it is so liberated that it's not really trying to do anything other than to make itself into a commodity. But that's another problem. But at that comes at the cost of sex. And is that a trade-off that you recognize within your theorization?
I hesitate to answer because, you know, But is... I mean, okay, so you think But is But prepared a certain...
No.
Desexualizing?
I've made a very, very silly, slippery slope proposition. Of course not. It's interesting that you are so invested in a single cultural artifact, and that's that. But that's maybe more about you than about the world's culture. You tried to make a step further away from the state in which Butler left gender by say the year 2000, and you're trying to find examples in your case study here of gender not being performative. And I think you do actually come quite close to exploring aspects of this in the text. You talk about the distinction between pornography and post-pornography. So in as much as we so far agreed that But was not pornography, it's an exponent of something else. And this is not a very precise question because I haven't taken enough is post-pornography somehow non-sexual suddenly?
Yes. Let's talk about sexuality then and not just about gender, you know? And the title of the book is Queer Masculinities and Affective Sexualities, which is a bit of an elegant compound.
It's a very good queer theory title.
So let's talk about this, the combination of affects and sexuality. Yeah. So what I was, and that I think leads to this question of, you know, a desexualized present or a certain kind of, at least say, lack of discourse about sexuality or lack of public for sexuality. So I think part of But's strategy to distinguish itself from corporate porn was to also introduce a different form of sexuality that is less instrumental, that is more personalized. You know, I mean, But we have individual portraits. We get the names, the individual names of the people being interviewed. They're emphasized. I mean, one approach would be to say it brings back the personal into sexuality, not just optimized anonymous bodies, but individually, personally diverging bodies. And this implies also a different understanding of sexuality, which I call affective sexualities. Yeah. In queer theory, since the 2000s, since Eve Sedgwick, really, Eve Sedgwick's work of the late 1990s and early 2000s, there has been a competition between investigating sexuality and affects. Yeah. Whereas early queer theory was really just talking about fucking when it talked about sexuality, even though from Freud we already know that it's not just about genital sex, but sexuality is so much more. It was only in the late 1990s and early 2000s that, especially through Eve Sedgwick, the question of affect came into play. So how can queerness manifest itself we're not just talking about sexual acts, specifically genital sexual acts. How do queer people feel differently, or how does queer intimacy look like? You know, and since Butt had such a strong investment in showing non-commodified gay men and their vulnerability, and also had an investment in showing, maybe let's just say, more tender forms of sexuality, or giving intimacy and vulnerability at least the same space as perversion. And perversion, I mean here in the best and most celebratory sense. And I think this is it's an interesting dance that Butt is performing here, because I think Butt doesn't want to go completely to, but maybe also sees the risk of, you know, becoming desexualized by talking about affect, but it also wants to talk about intimacy, you know. And it's also maybe we could also, again, you know, if we look at this historically, say intimacy has been so phobically marked after AIDS, not just in the sexual sense, but also, you know, in a more encompassing physical sense. I mean, intimacy between gay men was a taboo. So Butt wants to bring this back, not just as unprotected anal sex, but also as a you know, being together of gay men and showing this man and the enjoyment of that. Anyways, so I call this a dance because Butt wants to bring this back and cherishes this form of culture, but it also makes these gestures of remaining perverse, you know, and make sure to bring porn stars back into the magazine. Make sure to talk about penis sizes. Make sure to talk about different sizes of asses, you know. So there is, I think it doesn't want to lose that connection to queer perversion while at the same time opening up a different world. If we ask the question whether Butt contributed to a desexualized gay and queer present, would say it can be used this way. It could be read this way. You know, it has that part. I think the Butt Project is about something else, but I think it can be reframed like that. Yes.
Well, I'll refrain from writing an essay reaching that conclusion. It's my suspicion. You said something very interesting there, which actually leads me to one of my final questions. It's just to do with the community and the togetherness that Butt tries to bring. And of course, it's nothing particularly special about the idea that a fanzine, a zine, would have a kind of subculture attached to it. But in its, particularly it's in the online manifestation, seems to navigate the, at the time in the 2000s, emerging internet landscape with a little bit of a kind of contrary mission, yet again, and unsurprisingly by this time. So it has a personal section called Buttheads, and that's bizarrely still online. So people who showed us their butts in the early 2000s signed up for the service are still immortalized, quite a few of them with the surnames and you know, personal identifying characteristics. So this is all open to the world, which is kind of endearing. And it's endearing in a number of ways that goes beyond the kind of naivety of the openness. It's also to do with the aesthetics, the fact that all the website is in black and white for some reason, the kind of questions and interactions that these people engage in. So I want you to maybe speculate a little bit about what it is that Butt was able to do in terms of community creation. I mean, given we're, of course, talking about a kind of cult magazine, I'm too scared even to ask you about its print circulation in case it turns out, but it was 20. And we're talking about a subculture so small that only you really, you and Benedict Taschen.
We're talking about a couple of thousands. I don't have the exact numbers, although, hold on, I do know that, you know, we do have a relaunch of Butt this year. So Butt 30 appeared this spring in Paris, and Butt number 31 just
it's out. Recommend it to all listeners who want to see.
I was while you were talking, I was just like browsing through my emails, because I chatted with Joop van Bennekom, one of the two editors of Butt, this morning. I wanted to have permission to reprint images for a book, for a different book project of a friend of mine, where an article of mine appears, and he just told me Butt 30 is printed in 10,000 copies. 10,000 copies.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it has been sold out since it was, you know, launched in March, the first the relaunch.
It's definitely a cult interest now.
Yes. The question is just like whether 50-something-year-old guys like me are buying it or whether there's a new generation of people out there that discover that.
Well, those are the questions I'd like to speculate on,
yeah,
from your perspective as an informed observer and theorist, because I think it matters. If that political project had any currency then, its political potential now really does warrant re-examination.
Mm.
Because it's not like Batrax, you know, completed its project necessarily.
No, of course. I mean, if we raise the question about is there a bot community and how does it manifest itself? I mean, to be honest, my impression always was that the butthead thing does not really work. I mean, I have no data to prove that, but butthead, you know, as the social media platform for butt fans and butt readers, whether that worked as a platform where people really met and connected, I'm not sure. I really don't know. I doubt it a little bit. I always read it more as a more ungenerously as a bit of a narcissistic gesture to claiming, you know,
my God, gay men being narcissists. Who would have thought
that? As a narcissistic gesture to claim your value as, you know, as a butt person, as someone who could potentially also appear in butt, right, to partake in the butt. But universe and the butt project was always also making this flattening the distinction between professionals and amateurs, and readers of butt became models in butt or storytellers in butt, etc., and were treated on the same level, you know, as celebrities. So but whether it worked in the sense of creating a community through these technologies, I have my doubts. I mean, there is what I can say from my own experience. You know, Bud had a couple of side products and projects, like producing towels. You mentioned the Taschenbuchs, and also organized parties. For example, in Berlin, I went to two or three of them, and there was a certain, you know, let's just say, a certain kind of homosexual creative class that gathered at these butt meetings, right? So in that respect, also the title of my book, Hipster Porn, is really justified. You know, I think that there was a hipness created around the butt movement that manifested itself in these parties, in buying these articles. And, you know, we haven't talked about beard culture yet, but obviously, you know, the whole gay beard culture of the past 20 years, but contributed to that, and also kind of.
I can append a picture of your beard to the show notes, and we can just cover that. Yeah, no, but just to do a tiny bit for listeners who are by now wondering with academic stuff, is you do devote quite a bit of space to the idea of to the question of body hair, and I think that's one of the things you do really beautifully and accessibly in a book. But
thank you. I'm really obviously interested in you know, asking the question how does this materialize, or is this in some ways effective for the culture of 2022. My first response would be more sober and simply say, you know, in a typical culture studies manner, well, this is what happens in capitalism. You know, every youth and subculture style is going to be corrupted by capitalism and turns into a commodity. And this is what happened with butt as well. And yes, you know, since 2010, the latest, a majority of gay men between 20 and 50 or so in urban gay hubs in the West try to look like the boys from Butt. You know, that has happened. So Butt, the hipster style of Butt, has become hegemonic and probably in the sense of it's a reclaiming of masculinity for gay men, you know, in this most simplistic version. I think that has happened, you know, against but best intentions, maybe. And so, but is that it, you know, or is there more to it? I don't have a theoretical answer to that. I only can give you maybe some anecdotes or descriptions. So from my work in Berlin of the past 4 years, you know, I've been working a lot with contemporary young queer artists that live in Berlin, many of them, you know, non-Germans, a lot of people from North America, from Israel, from Southern Europe, you know, that contribute to the queer art scene in the city. You know, Spyros Rent, for example, a Greek photographer that now lives in Berlin. And he is one of the contributors of But 30, you know, and this is the case for a couple of others. So there is a generation of gay men, let's say maybe in their 30s or so, that grew up with But, that were kids when But emerged, but that for whom But was already a convention when they appeared. Mm. And they are continuing this kind of work. Some of it looks very close to the But aesthetics, almost non-distinguishable from But. But I also think there's interesting ways of developing this further, or also to document how queer kids in Berlin Neukölln and Kreuzberg live in the 2020s is different, you know, and it owes a lot to the But aesthetics, but it's also a different world where this style is already given as a convention, but pictures change something. I mean, I'm a little bit, as I said, you know, I don't really have an interpretation here yet. Yeah. It's more of an observation. So But's impact on that generation is very clear, but I don't want to be as fast as saying, well, it's nothing but a copy of But. I mean, that would be horribly ungenerous and untrue.
So Peter, finally, I want to ask you in a mode of kind of hyper-speculation, what do you see the challenges for queer theory of today are? So we discussed a little bit, you know, what it is that But managed to achieve and how it applies to Neukölln, Berlin, circa 2022. But queer theory, of course, is in a place in terms of its exposure, in terms of its role in culture generally, on a completely different level. Not only is it addressing different audiences, different expressions of gender and sexuality, it also has a very, very different relationship to capital and globalization. So what's on your wish list? What does queer theory need to do now to save itself from, well, both cultural appropriation and this kind of complete explosion of its unwitting success in certain senses?
I'm old-fashioned in this respect, and I am, you know, what I've also done with the book, in a way, I do promote a return to the beginning of queer theory, not to ignore the also, in parts, very just demands that have been made on queer theory in the past 15 years, but primarily because I see it as a huge problem. I see the desexualizing tendencies within queer theory as a huge problem, you know. And I think, for example, if gay men have anything to contribute to queer, it's sex. It's about, you know, we have to talk about fisting, we have to talk about drugs, we have to talk about the gay sex life, and we have to explore how, what that does to people, how relationships are being changed through that. And if we, you know, and that's, if we put a taboo on that, which is even stranger to me, because I think that the pharmaceutical changes of the past 15 years, you know, treatment as prevention for HIV positive people, and also Truvada PrEP as a prophylaxis against HIV prevention, and the online connectivity created a new sexual culture in which, you know, factually, gay men, for example, are very experimental in their behavior and are very creative in, you know, not having new experiences, but also new forms of relationships. This used to be the source for queer theory, but it's completely, these days, it's, with a few exceptions, completely cut off from queer theory. No one talks about contemporary gay sexual culture anymore. That's a huge problem. And, you know, a couple of people, including most famously maybe Tim Dean, who has just published also a book on why America hates sex, I think this is something we totally have to go back to. But I also want to say I don't mean this by ignoring the turns of queer theory of the past 15 years. That's also very important to me. You know, I think the queer of color critique by José Muñoz and others was very justified. And I think to politicize queer also in a way by connecting it to other subject positions and identities that have not been part of the queer conversation so much in the 1990s is unnecessary. And we don't want to fall back behind that. The question is, of course, and that's not just a question for queer, but for the post-colonial discourse and, you know, for most cultural forms of criticism on the left, how do we escape the traps of identity politics? How can we make the claim for identities that are on a certain level of political business completely necessary, because otherwise you're not represented and you cannot make political claims? But how do we escape the traps that come with these forms of categorizations? That's a question and a different conversation.
Yeah, I mean, that I think that's an important question, to be able to find a way to salvage what's left of critical theory, or in the original, as you were characterizing it, in a way that it can not stand, find itself in complete opposition with this kind of contemporary manifestations that rely so heavily on identity politics. And it's not like the job is done. The fact that identity politics is so entwined with capital that it's essentially just self-destructing, that doesn't necessarily let the originals of critical theory and queer theory off the hook. So it's very heartening to hear you talk about sexuality and sex as, you know, as a sort of processes that mechanistically need to be considered. I wrote a text recently trying to think a little bit about the relationship between morality and biopolitics when it came to the monkeypox vaccine. And I thought about my own experience of going to a sexual health clinic, Dean Street Express, which happens to be the busiest sexual health clinic in Europe, where everything is done by QR code. You know, if you do drugs and you do fisting and you go to chemsex parties, you don't tell a person that, you tell an iPad that. And of course, it's all super non-judgmental. They text you, everything is fine. But When I went once to a more old-fashioned clinic, suddenly for the first time in maybe 15 years of me being an adult and thinking about these things, someone was asking me why I was having a particular type of sex. Like, you know, what was the morality of this? Oh, should you be doing this? And I've just realized that actually by not talking about sex in very explicit terms, we have got to a point where, well, whoever has the easiest solution decides how these things play out. So yeah. Monkeypox, maybe rightly from a utilitarian point of view, everyone politely queued up to get vaccinated. But it was for me this kind of moment where you realize, oh, we don't have an apparatus to talk about the relationship between sex and what it means for individuals, for communities. And these are the things like queer theory, one of the early exponents of being able to talk about sexuality without giggling, was supposed to be able to do. When that's been relegated into the realm of social conservatism, there's the fact that it's right-wingers who have to ask about should gay men be fucking while there's a virus at, the fact that that brings back the conversations from the 80s and whatever the gay community, if it still constitutes itself like that, has no answer to that, should be slightly frightening.
Maybe just a last word on that. I mean, academia doesn't want to talk about sex, you know, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. I think there was a window between 1987 and 1997 where this was made possible, especially in North American academia. And it was made possible, again, a bit paradoxically through HIV and AIDS. I think that the impact of AIDS was so violent, and it was so, by the late 1980s, it was so, especially again in North America with its different health plan system, et cetera, and a different political culture and all of that. So that there was an urgency to responding to it intellectually that was exceptional. And I think this made queer theory as a conversation about sexualities possible. But at the same time, you know, the majority of people in academia or academia as an institution was also quite happy when this was no longer necessary.
Peter, thank you. I have one last question, which is who should we look out for in the next Eurovision?
I mean, it's too early to say because, as you know, the entries are not being submitted until the beginning of the year.
I presume you have some insider knowledge. But...
I cannot because I think maybe for one or two candidates, nothing has been decided yet. How I can answer the question is, of course, you know, there's always a specific constellation where. I mean, there's always surprises, yes, but there's also always a specific constellation where certain countries have an investment in Eurovision and certain countries don't. And we could say, just very briefly, the heydays of Eastern Europe are over. That was the 2000s, you know, analogously. So the times when Serbia and... you know, other countries had a very strong, Russia had a very strong interest in winning Eurovision and, you know, got the best Swedish producers and songwriters to get a catchy tune that would appeal to all of Europe. That time is over for a couple of reasons. You know, I think they arrived in Europe, including the European Union in different ways. It's also an economic question, of course, you know, Eurovision is also expensive. Not everybody wants to win at Eurovision because it's expensive. I know the UK is doing it voluntarily.
I mean, at the moment it's turning out quite well because our currency is so weak that we would desperately need all the tourists to turn up and spend a little bit of whatever they have. But
I mean, I love the UK to be the host next year, but that's, you know, I totally do. I think it's a really, very interesting moment of, you know, not just with becoming second this year, but also with hosting it, having a look of what that does to UK Eurovision culture, which on the one hand is so totally important for Eurovision and the discourse and the culture of Eurovision, while at the same time, you know, with the cynicism, not just irony, but also the cynicism with which UK participation in Eurovision has been met. You know, to look at that while the contest is in the UK, that will be very interesting to me. Anyways, and also a way of bringing UK back to Europe in a way. Anyways, that's a different story.
Good luck with that. I'll come back to you for tips closer to the time and definitely look forward to your next book. Peter, thank you so much for the conversation. Thank you for the book.
Thank you for taking the time and for the interest.
Hipster Porn, Queer Masculinities and Affective Sexualities in the Fanzine Butt by Peter Rebert is published by Routledge. I'm Pierre Lanser, and the editor is Marcia Poe. Thanks for listening and join us next time.